This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It is a real challenge sometimes to convince authorities, particularly national governments, that there are special areas that are really important for wildlife that we need to set aside. You need to leave a legacy that if we don't salvage, protect these areas now, they will be lost forever.
There's more than one way to support ecological conservation. Today on Sea Change Radio, we talk with two individuals working on different fronts for the same cause. First, I speak with Dr. Paul Solomon, the CEO of the Rainforest Trust, an international conservation organization. We talk about the organization's efforts to defend fragile ecosystems, the technologies they use to monitor the species they protect, and their methods for engaging indigenous peoples, governments, and private companies to set aside land and ensure the preservation of vulnerable species. Then we hear from Shilpi Chotre, an ocean advocate for Mission Blue, who's also the founder of Samudra Skin and Sea, a line of sustainable beauty products. If Chotre's name sounds familiar, it may be because she was a Sea Change Radio guest in 2014, talking about the role of women in the burgeoning seaweed industry in India. That work in India inspired Chotre to create a company that offers an alternative to conventional beauty products. Samudra Skin and Sea helps protect the ocean by crafting creams that use sustainably harvested seaweed, avoiding plastic throughout its supply chain, and partnering with ocean advocacy organizations to support a shared mission of ocean conservation.
Who are these children who scheme and run wild? Who speak with their wings in the way that they smile? What are the secrets they trace in the sky? And why do you tremble each time they ride by? Throw out your gold teeth and see how they roll. The answer they reveal, life is unreal.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dr. Paul Solomon. He's the CEO of Rainforest Trust. Paul, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much. It was great to be here with you, Alex.
For folks who don't know what the Rainforest Trust is, maybe you could give us a little background on the organization. It hasn't always been called the Rainforest Trust, has it?
That's correct. We were formed in 1988 to help establish protected areas across the tropics. We were formerly World Land Trust, US, and 3 years ago we changed our name to Rainforest Trust, given that we focused almost exclusively on protecting the most endangered rainforests for species at risk of extinction throughout the tropics. And so over the last 27 years, we've helped protect over 15 million acres of really crucial habitat for the most endangered species. And that has been our focus for the last 27 years. We've continued to make sure that our mission has not changed and is key to everything we do.
And let's dive into some of the work that you and your colleagues have been involved in recently. It's not all rainforest, despite the name Rainforest Trust. Why don't you first tell us about the work that you and your colleagues have been doing in Nepal in protecting the red panda there?
Sure. So the core of our mission is to try to focus on saving the most endangered species in the tropics. And invariably, some of those species aren't just in rainforest. They occur in, for example, the cloud forests of the Himalayas, or they may occur in the savannas of the Pantanal and wetlands in, say, for example, Brazil or Argentina. We try to make sure that our efforts are pinpointed on the ground with tangible actions. In the case of the red panda, this is a species that is at great risk from poaching and from a lack of habitat loss. So key to our work has been to establish a network of protected areas in its core range and working with local people, people that would otherwise poach or damage the habitat of the species. We work with these people to help protect the panda and provide alternative incomes. And so core to our project in Nepal has been this establishment with communities setting aside areas of forest for the red panda, and in return providing them with support and capacity to protect the area and reap other benefits that don't involve harming the species or clearing the forest.
I imagine that some of the challenges you face as an organization is working with different governments, especially when you're talking about a large landmass that you're trying to set aside to preserve a species. If this landmass either borders on other nations or crosses into other nations, you operate in Africa and South America, and obviously there's going to be some butting of heads.
Yeah, definitely. It is a great challenge. There's a huge number of pressures on the limited natural resources on our planet, whether it be simply timber or whether it be mining or farming, encroachment, things like that. There's a lot of pressures on the last wild places and intact habitats on our planet. And it is a real challenge sometimes to convince authorities, particularly national governments, that there are special areas that are really important for wildlife that we need to set aside. You need to leave a legacy that if we don't salvage, protect these areas now, they will be lost forever. So, for example, in Peru, we had a huge project there to create a new national park called Sierra de Divisor. It ran along the border with Brazil. Although it was only in Peru, there were tremendous pressures from Brazil that wanted to run roads into this wilderness area of Peru to basically have access to the resources in Peru and export them through Brazil. So creating a national park and shutting down the border with Brazil in a very key area was crucial, not just to protecting the national park, which itself was 3 million acres, but protecting tens of millions of acres of rainforest. And as important, the indigenous communities that occupied that area. Some of them haven't even been contacted before. They live in voluntary isolation. And so it's been really important working with the government, working with local organizations and entities. But at the end of the day, it wasn't Rainforest Trust, it wasn't, foreign governments. It was actually the indigenous communities in the area rallied to what we were trying to do. They realized how important it was, and they convinced the government that this was the right thing to do. And thanks to the indigenous communities, they have set aside a vast area. They have assured that the natural resources in Peru remain Peruvian, and that indigenous communities themselves, their lands will be recognized adjacent to this new national park. And so we're continuing to do that work with indigenous communities, build capacity, empower them, and make sure that any future threats that confront them, they will be confronted by a powerful and well-organized indigenous community.
And when natural resources come into play, and there is infighting over, let's say, logging rights or oil rights, how can a relatively small organization like Rainforest Trust stand up to some of these deep moneyed interests like Exxon, Chevron, or a big logging company or a government? How do you find allies in your struggle?
Well, we have yet to actually go head-to-heads with any of the major oil companies. I think what we're trying to focus on is not lobbying or confrontation. We're trying to focus on the ground, positive steps forward. And there is nothing more positive than building consensus and support within local communities by local conservationists. And people see the value in having something for a future for their children and their children's children. And even politicians get this. And if we are strategic and we focus on the areas that really need the help, obviously we're not going to save every last tree on the planet, but we are going to target the areas that are really crucial for communities and for biodiversity, I believe that we can really make a difference. And we are. And that's what Rainforest Trust is doing. We are working in specific sites, tangible areas having concrete results. We're able to show every acre that we protect And we're able to show that every community embraces these and continues to support them. Invariably, there are forests being lost every day, and that will continue to be a challenge. But I think that it's important to be positive and know that we can still make a difference and still salvage the most important areas.
There's those thinking more, less is more. But if less is more, how you keeping score? It means for every point you make, your level drops. Kinda like you're starting from the top. And you can't do that, society. You're a crazy breed. I hope you're not lonely without me. Society, crazy indeed. I hope you're not lonely without me. Society.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Dr. Paul Solomon. He's the CEO of Rainforest Trust. So, Paul, can you give us some specific examples of animals that have responded well to Rainforest Trust conservation efforts?
Absolutely. Well, one of the best examples was a project that I was involved with for the last 18 years, and that was to protect the yellow-eared parrot, which was a critically endangered macaw-sized parrot in Colombia. That species was down to 81 individuals, much like kind of the passenger pigeon. It was once a super abundant bird across the Andes of Colombia, and had plummeted to just one last population, and it was crashing. The population was crashing. Then I was a student.
You're a trained ornithologist, right?
That's correct. I was motivated and enthused from the age of 8 to protect tropical places. I was very lucky. I met Sir David Attenborough when I was 8 years old. He'd just come back from Rwanda, having been with the mountain gorillas, and he was so excited, and it was so infectious. I think I caught that bug, and I continue to this day to do what he had evangelized to me. And so, having been trained with a background in ornithology, and having found the last population of this particular parrot, this was back in 1999, we have moved to protect its habitat, work with local communities, and they have totally embraced that this was a special species. They had no idea that it was only found in these last areas and that this was so special for them. They totally got behind the species, and thanks to their work and local conservationists, we were able to protect the species. And today, we've lost count. There's over 2,000 individuals today. And I believe firmly, and this is shown time and time again, when we give nature a space to thrive, when we give them protection, a nature reserve, a park or whatever, they will thrive. They will bounce back. They will, you know, jump at the chance, and we don't have to do anything. We didn't have to put them in a zoo. We didn't have to put them in a cage. They did it themselves. We just got to allow them the room to do it.
So, Paul, maybe you can speak towards some of the technological innovations that you and your colleagues use when you're trying to keep track of some of these animals. A lot of us have seen on nature shows critter cams and camera traps and things like that, but also drones have now kind of come into the picture.
That's right. I think that the challenges that we face, we're trying to embrace all of technology to help us. Certainly there's, you know, free and accessible tools like Google Earth that have updated high resolution imagery down to centimeters. You can see large chunks of the planet, and there's almost updated now on a monthly basis, so we can see if people are clearing forest near our protected areas, we can alert our conservation partners on the ground. We can mobilize the teams of local communities that are supporting the protection of these areas. We also have deployed drones to survey areas in more remote areas. It's just a good use of the limited resources that we have to survey areas and assess what is going on the ground. We try to avoid, expensive, vehicles and things like that, things that could get broken and cost a lot. We'd rather focus on small technology, things like camera traps, the trail cameras we use for, that hunters use in the U.S. Those deployed across reserves are invaluable. It's a way of monitoring the wildlife, jaguars and tapirs and things like that that are walking the trails in our protected areas. But it also is a way of checking that there's not hunters walking through areas or that people aren't going in and trying to take out wood. I mean, there's lots of different little innovative technology that we're using with our partners, we're training them on, and it just ensures that at the end of the day that the areas we protect remain in perpetuity in protection. It's so important. And I think it's also the real key to all of this has been making sure that local communities are involved and empowered within these areas. They are 99% of the solution or the problem, and so having them on board is absolutely critical to making these areas a success.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Dr. Paul Solomon. He's the CEO of Rainforest Trust. Talking about some of these innovations and technologies that allow you to track animals and survey the land that you're setting aside for them, where are the biggest needs for your organization in terms of resources? If somebody decided to give money to your organization, where should they expect it to go?
Sure. Well, we're really proud that we've stuck to our principles of getting as much funding on the ground as possible. And we're very grateful. We have a wonderful board of directors that have provided the core operating expenses for our organization. And what that does is it's allowed 100% of all of the donations to our projects to be dedicated to those projects and to do conservation directly in the field, real tangible action, to set aside areas in permanent protection. So this is something that's been recognized by Charity Navigator and other authorities. Our operating costs are less than 5% of our total expenditure. And as I say, thanks to our board, we're able to count on those resources. We have been able to put so much funding on the ground for local conservationists and communities to set aside key areas. It really, these projects are growing and growing. We've got more and more attention from local conservationists that have got great ideas. They've got motivation. They're totally dedicated and passionate in what they want to do, but they lack the resources to scale up and get these areas set aside as protection, whether it be land purchase compensating folks for local land that can be put into nature reserves, or whether it be working with local communities to plan for and establish national parks or national sanctuaries, wildlife reserves. It all takes funding to organize and coordinate on the ground. And so that's where our dedicated supporters have been so important. Providing the funding to make these projects happen has really made a difference.
He's the CEO of Rainforest Trust, Dr. Paul Solomon. Paul, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex. It was great to talk to you.
See the rain and it's
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
Want to welcome back to Sea Change Radio, Shilpi Chotre. Shilpi, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
So last time you were here, you were working as an ocean advocate for Future 500, and we discussed the innovations that are going on in the seaweed harvesting industry, particularly with female employees. Since then, you've joined Mission Blue as an ocean advocate still, but you have a new company, a skincare company made of seaweed, ironically.
Yes.
Called Samudra Skin and Sea. So why don't you first explain the connection from the piece that we discussed to where you are now with this company?
Sure. So Samudra Skin and Sea is an ocean-inspired skincare line featuring wild-harvested sustainable seaweed. And our products are organic, natural, and vegan. And our core ingredient is sustainable harvested seaweed. And the reason for seaweed is the amazing health benefits it has, not only for our body as we intake it internally, but it has incredible benefits for the skin as well. It's full of essential vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and also anti-aging properties. And just like we see it in our sushi and in our food, I wanted to create something that addressed the largest organ in our body, which is our skin, through really high-quality, edible-grade seaweed.
And how is most of the seaweed that we get in a sushi roll harvested? Is that sustainable?
It depends on where it's from. So at Samudra, we're working with a commercial harvester that has innate knowledge of the marine ecosystem. He's been working off the coast of Northern California for over 20 years. And what he does with his seaweed harvesting method is wildcrafting, which means conservation and quality are going hand in hand. The process with this company that I work with called Rising Tide Sea Vegetables is visiting only one remote location once a year and never uprooting the plant. So you're literally trimming it like you would hair, and you're getting enough seaweed harvest volume for the rest of the year during this particular season. So it's a really, really unique, sustainably driven process, and it's completely organic. So the beauty of seaweed is it's inherently sustainable since it only needs water and sunlight to flourish. No pesticides are needed. And the less interference we have with the marine environment, the better it is for ocean ecosystems to thrive and function.
So what was the inspiration for using seaweed in your skincare? Was it first the seaweed and then you decided you knew that was good for your skin and you wanted to make a skincare product? Or was it you wanted to make a skincare product and seaweed connected those dots for you?
Well, like I was here last time talking with you, I was so inspired by what I saw in India with the women and seaweed-driven employment opportunities that I really wanted to create something, knowing that seaweed had amazing socioeconomic opportunities for women especially. It was inherently a sustainable resource, and it is very, very great for health. So I took that knowledge I had, and a couple years ago, actually, I fell into some severe allergic reactions to food. And I found that when I had these allergic reactions and these triggers, I would get severe eczema and dry skin on parts of my body. And whenever I'm in the ocean around seaweed and salt water, I feel a lot more relief. So I kind of combined my knowledge and passion for the marine environment and with these health issues I was going through myself to create a skincare line using seaweed.
And for listeners who missed our initial interview about India and seaweed harvesting, maybe you can just give us an executive summary of our discussion.
Absolutely. So in India, what's happening, and this is not just in India, but most developing areas of the world, Tanzania, Indonesia, Philippines as well, because of overfishing and climate change, there's a reduced amount of fish available in the ocean. And farmers are turning more and more to seaweed farming because it's a plant and it grows very easily, like I said, with just sunlight and water. And there's a whole market for aquaculture as well, which you can grow seaweed in a controlled environment. And more often than not, the majority of farmers for seaweed are women. And a lot of times it's the first paid work they've ever had. And it's a lot less labor intensive than other produce or fishing, for instance.
And do you see this as a positive development for the employment of women in developing countries?
Yes, definitely. I think it's an extremely positive development. In India, for instance, the government is identifying self-help groups, which are women that are in desperate need of jobs and economic employment. And seaweed is offering them opportunities to have jobs, stay in a community environment. Typically, the seaweed is handled in groups of 4 to 6 women, so they're never alone. And they can, you know, work while having their kids nearby. And it's a really great community-based model for sustaining livelihoods.
So Samudra Skin and Sea is a very small enterprise still. Why don't you give us a snapshot of where the company is and what you hope it will become?
Yes.
And maybe where people can buy it.
So Samudra Skin and Sea, we are in 5 San Francisco locations, but we also launched our online shop just last month. So you can visit www.samudraskinsea.com.
What does Samudra mean, by the way?
Samudra means ocean in Sanskrit. So when I was visiting India in 2014, I learned that Samudra meant ocean. And so I always thought I would keep message intact in whatever initiatives I would do. Right now we have 4 introductory products. We have a biodegradable soap bar for hair and body. This is focused for people that are camping, they're enjoying the great outdoors, and they want to be socially, environmentally responsible. So it's completely sulfate-free, paraben-free, fragrance-free. We have a body butter. It's hydrating, it's moisture-rich. It features certified organic shea butter, of course, our wild seaweed, maracuja, and argan oils. We also have a face cream, which is really, really, it's a deep moisture intensive face cream. So a little bit's going to go a long way. And we sell that in a 2-ounce jar. And then finally, we have a detoxifying face mask, which includes really cool ingredients like activated charcoal, which is going to pull toxins out of the body and really give the skin a polished look. So these are our 4 introductory ingredients. We're adding 2 more for this holiday season, so stay tuned on those. They're a bit of a surprise. And we are hoping to grow in other retail locations. We're looking at Rainbow Grocery here in San Francisco to join their collection of skincare goods as well.
So earlier in the program, Shilpi, we heard from Paul Solomon, whose organization, the Rainforest Trust, tries to protect land-based creatures. The organization you work for, Mission Blue, focuses on cleaning and protecting our oceans. Why don't you explain how this type of protection helps seaweed harvesting?
That's a great question. So marine protected areas definitely help Samudra and other brands that are looking at seaweed, because we have to use the seaweed sustainably if you're in a marine reserve and you have to have permits to do so. So not only does it safeguard the resources for generations to come, it ensures that we're sustainably harvesting the seaweed now.
Shilpi Chotre, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Steely Dan, Eddie Vedder, and Bruce Hornsby. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.